I think it's about 12 miles north. Empire, whatever the distance is between there and World Trade. So a lot of people have got it more pointed in the right direction. But people in New Jersey got TV like they never got it before. It was about 3 months after we got Alpine up and running that we got Empire up and running, and that's with the antennas on the 83rd floor.
I'm guessing that we on Long Island suffered with Alpine because of three possible factors. Number one, the antenna was not as high as Empire or World Trade. Number two, the transmitter's at the bottom of the tower, not the top of the building, so you get feed line loss. Number three, the antenna maybe didn't have as much gain at Alpine. It was a temporary antenna. And number four was the power output of the transmitter the same. So did Alpine have lower power output transmitter, greater feed line loss, lower antenna gain, and lower antenna altitude? And greater mileage to it? Other than that, Alpine was great for us on Long Island. Is any of that true, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2J. Well, some of the above, not all of the above. That's still started at the beginning. The antennas are exactly the same. They're delta wings. They're not very high gain antennas to start with. At World Trade, the PPO of the transmitter was 24 kilowatts, I think. So that was, that was a 4CX 24,000 that ran that transmitter. That in turn had to go into a combiner that then went up to the antennas, which is really not that far. I think there's only, and that was using 3 1/8 or 6 1/8, I forget. No, that was 3 1/8. The years were 6 1/8 and 8 inch. At Alpine, again, the antennas exactly the same, lower in altitude, and the transmitter that we was actually on its way to a station in Portland, Oregon, and it got diverted to us, and that was only a 5 kilowatt transmitter, and it was solid state. I think it was like 750 feet AGL, and don't forget, the power stage is sitting up there, I think, 300 or 400 feet, I forget what the number is.
So Alpine was solid state, 5 kilowatts. Was the 5 kilowatts at the base of the tower or up at altitude on the tower?
That was TPO, transmitter power output. That's before it hit anything. But it was just a straight piece of 3-inch heliax that went up the tower.
So 700 feet of 3-inch, 750 feet of 3-inch heliax?
Yeah, I think where we were was actually like just 700.
So that cable had a couple of dB of loss at least, knocking that 5 kilowatts down, isn't that true, Eric?
Yeah, and then you wound up with, 7 dB of gain in the antenna.
Which is the same gain of the antenna you would have at World Trade. And the combiner at Alpine and the combiner at World Trade are probably...
Combiner at Alpine.
So, in other words, how many of the channels were operational during that month at Alpine?
Well, CBS didn't bother to come because they were still at Empire, so they were happily on the air when the World Trade Center went down. Channel 11 had a transmitter on the top of the Daily News building on the east side of Manhattan at 42nd Street, which you could barely pick up anywhere. I think they were running a kilowatt. So let's see, there was us, there was ABC, and there was 9. And there was Fox. That was it.
Interesting. quite an episode.
Oh, and Channel 25 was coming at it for me.
25? Right now I get 25 by way of four times squared, don't I?
Correct.
But there's another transmitter site in Brooklyn where Channel 25 can come out of? What building is that?
Brooklyn College. You can talk to N2RQ and use the occupied space there. But power and all that stuff is gone now, from what I gathered.
So, that Brooklyn location is not a standby for 25. You're saying they've abandoned that installation?
Yeah, they moved out of there. That whole operation was there. There's actually an old high school. But, yeah, no, that's all gone.
Okay. I think it's time for a space report. And one of the things that Paul Mabee is going to be telling us about is that the way you can earn, there's a way that the general citizen, a scientifically oriented citizen, can earn $30,000 from NASA just by solving a problem that they're working on. When an astronaut wears a spacesuit, rarely is he in that spacesuit for more than 8 hours, for anything, even up to 8 hours is the maximum. However, they know there's going to be future operations in which an astronaut would need to be in a spacesuit for a much longer period of time. Most likely, you're going to be changing out oxygen bottles and things like that in his backpack. However, Paul's going to tell you what the problem is. WS2N with space report number 239, K2RIW. You got it, Paul. Keep it clean. I'm having some fun with him.
Barry, he had a question there. I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. I know I saw the email. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I forgot about that. N2 moonbound. K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Hey, guys. Yeah, it was a quick question. Whatever happened to World Trade, are they going to move back there, or is that forgotten?
They put in one hell of a broadcast mast, and I can't believe that they're not going to be using it. Let's see what Eric's got to say. How many stations have already started the installation at this, let me think now, 700, let's see, what's the year of 1776, I think it is? So 1,776 feet above ground, there's a mast at the Freedom Tower. And how many of the broadcast stations are going to and have begun moving over there? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
KE2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, that's a whole other story. Actually, we're going to start doing our installation in about 3 months. Not everybody's going there. Everybody pays for their space, but a bunch of folks are not moving there. I don't know if they're going to stay where they are. We're going there. I'm not sure who else is going there. I don't have the list in front of me, so I don't remember. But only a couple of us. And by the way, that mast, which ends at 1776 feet, at the very top of it, they designed it to have a radome, except that the radome that they designed, it was designed by architects, not engineers, all these little metal things that hold it together. That's why there's no radome on that thing.
One of the PBS programs about skyscrapers talked about the installation of that mast. And at first it was going to have a radome, and they found that the wind loading was intolerable, and it would oscillate. So therefore they removed the radome around that mast, and now it's just bare pieces of metal, and the wind can drift through it, and it's a lot more stable. But I guess there was a little bit of a controversy that the mast, if it has a radome, it's considered part of the building. If it doesn't have a radome, it's considered a mast on top of the building, and therefore the rated altitude of the building is the habitable portion, not including the mast. How'd they get around all of that? And so I think you're saying PBS is going to go over to the mast, I'm guessing PBS is going to be relatively low on the mast because the penthouse of that mast, I guarantee, is a lot more expensive. What's your guesses on my part? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, actually, that's not true. The antennas is a community antenna, so it's all the high Vs and one antenna. There are no low Vs, so don't even worry about it. And then there's the U's, which is another... Actually, the U's are at the very tippy top, between the top ring and the next ring down. The V's are the next one down, so, you know, well, everybody's pretty much at the top.
Will there be auxiliary antennas down low so that the a man climbing the mast can switch which area is doing the transmitting?
Stage of the game, the short answer to that is no. That's why our standby is at, that's one of the reasons why standby is at four times square.
So you're saying that PBS, channel 13 and channel 21 have a standby at four times square, and therefore, when you do switch over to Freedom Tower, you just simply turn off Freedom Tower. Over to you, Eric.
When maintenance is going on, Freedom Tower will go off the air. And if you are lucky enough to have another spot, like Empire or Times Square, that's the way you go back on the air. But, I don't remember who it was. You know, I'll look it up and I'll tell you next week exactly who's going to be there and who's not going to be there.
Are roughly half the channels switching over and half of them are not switching over, Eric?
Now, from what I remember, there's only like three of us or four of us and a bunch of families, and that's it.
Are so few of them switching over because the extra altitude is not that big an advantage? Or is the new location going to be too expensive? What's the main reason some of them are not switching over?
Well, it varies. Empire is, like, not happy about losing clients, so they reduced the rent to some people. And that was an incentive for them to stay. Don't forget, insurance money is what's paying for the folks moving back to Freedom Tower. So for some people, the money is not the issue. But then there's the reality is that, you know, how much additional coverage do you get? They did, let's see, when was it? In the summer, they put up a temporary V and a temporary U and did surveys around it. And they compared that to Empire. Some folks feel it's not worth the effort.
Yeah, Dr. Bill and I had a discussion on that subject, and the extra altitude at first sounds very desirable, but because range is a function of square root of altitude in feet multiplied by 2, the slight difference in range doesn't sound like it's really worth it, if you know what I mean. And on top of that, let's see, Freedom Tower versus Empire. I guess there's not that much difference in how many miles north and south are there, is there. So, on top of that, I think the mast on Freedom Tower is in the vicinity of 400 or 450 feet tall. If the transmitter is going to be on one of the upper floors of Freedom Tower, it sounds like you're going through 450 feet of transmission line. That's going to create some interesting losses and group delay distortion. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, we don't have those issues. Come on, we've got towers in the Midwest that can be bad to beat it, you know, made it go up. But we have little screws in the side of the outside of, you know, the outer conductor of that cable. Actually, you know, it's rigid hard line. So when you install it, you've got a guy down at the bottom with a VNA telling you how to turn those screws.
I think you're talking about a kind of an equalizer assembly. And it's equalizing insertion loss, flatness, group delay. What's the main tuning requirement for that equalization, Eric? K2LIW?
The key here is group delay. That's the important thing. You know, you're not doing analog anymore, so you don't have to worry about a few other things.
Yeah, group delay distortion will start giving you inter-symbol distortion, and your real broadcast digital signal-to-noise ratio, I guess, is primarily a function of inter-symbol distortion. Is that roughly true?
If you've got bits knocking into each other, it doesn't help you. And, you know, having little bits being in exactly the right place is very useful. You know, even 400 feet of hardline, you've seen what it looks like. It has its characteristics. Loss is not something that's great, I think. At our frequency, the 3 1/8 loses something like, I'm not sure. It's a really low number for 100 feet, something like 0.1 or 0.0 something. I forget what it is, but it's a very low number. That loss is not so much the issue here as the ability to have the pipe be as non-inductive and non-reactive as possible.
You certainly don't want any triple transits going on in that pipe. That means the antenna itself has got to have very low vislar. For low insertion loss, you'd like to be using elliptical waveguides. I'm guessing you couldn't possibly tolerate the group delay on that. That's why what you are using...
Oh, no.
I assume that you're using coax instead of waveguide because of the group delay. Over to you, Eric.
Come on, you remember seeing my UHF transmitter, and I showed you... that whole transmitter was waveguide all the way out to where it curves to the base of the tower. Running waveguide like that up the tower is like, mucho expensive. It's coax. Much easier to mount, too.
Okay, so you're saying you rejected waveguide with a slightly lower loss because of dollars, not because of group delay? Waveguide has got group delay. Coax almost does not. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it's not so much cost, even. It's mounting. You know, when you start having multiple... How big was that waveguide? At 500 megahertz. It wasn't like, it wasn't like WR95. This stuff is, like, big.
It looks like air conditioning ducts. So you had great big chunks of waveguide that I presume went out to the base of the tower. Did that also go all the way up the tower?
Oh, actually, it ended at a patch panel inside, but one of the reasons why we like to use waveguide when you're doing 60 kilowatts or 80 kilowatts is you can make a magic key, and that works really nice.
So you run 60 or 80 kilowatts. I thought you told me you were running 24 kilowatts at the trade. Now I'm a little bit confused.
Talking about 21, it's 500 megahertz, not 213 megahertz.
Okay. So analog, you ran something like 60 kilowatts. And nowadays, I'm guessing you're running more like something like 4 kilowatts.
Yeah, my TPO is 4.625 kilowatts. Although, interestingly enough, ABCN 4 times square is running 18 kilowatts.
Nice number. Did Spagnoli predict what kind of range would come out of digital television? And was all of that range in a complicated area like New York City, was all of that really experienced?
So look, if you compare the grade B lines, now we're talking the grade B lines, not even the grade A lines, of the TV station. 90% of all the digital stations made their grade Bs without a problem. Okay, where you're talking about where you ain't getting nothing,
You're actually outside the grade B, whether you realize it or not.
So you're telling me the grade B back in the analog days and the grade B now with digital, you seem to be saying it's almost the exact same range, even though the ERP is quite a bit lower. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, the ERP is considerably lower. In essence, that most of the stations meet the original analog grade B. They just make it. I mean, it falls a little short in some places, but, you know, a lot of that is topography.
The total number of over-the-air antennas in Suffolk County is an extremely small fraction of what it used to be. Although, hold on now, I'm thinking of the old days before cable really became popular. Everybody switched over to cable because they wanted a zillion channels and a whole lot of sports and pay-per-view and so on. I guess I'm too far into the dark ages. I've never had any kind of cable TV, so therefore, I don't really know.
Yeah, but you know, in the analog days, the cable TV offered a huge improvement for the EastEnders in terms of picture quality.
I accept that. Okay. N2MB, I think you had a question. Is that true? Barry, did we give you a chance to ask your question? N2MB, K2IW?
Yeah, you've been talking about my question for 10 minutes. Yes, absolutely. But I have another one, and I think you just gently touched on it a second ago. The future of UHF TV altogether. What are the chances, like in the next 10 years, they're going to stop doing it? They might go over to cable or something like that. I mean, you know, what's the story with the future of UHF TV? I call it UHF. You know what I mean. This is N2MB.
We discussed that last week, and I'm going to try to find that article again. I think it was in Microwaves and RF magazine. They talked about the number of human beings. I think the answer is 47 million. Some crazy number of households are going to be watching over-the-air digital television. I think I found the page. Haven't found the exact page yet. We did discuss it a little bit last week, and maybe Eric remembers the number. It was some huge number that surprised the hell out of me. KE2EJ, oh, here it is. In 2017, we can expect 24 million non-paying television households. Their definition of non-paying is these people are not using cable, satellite, nothing. In 2017, we can expect 24 million non-paying television households in the United States. That's in the Microwaves and RF January issue 2017. And it's an article talking about five technology areas to watch for 2017. Eric might have some comment on this. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2IW, K2J. Okay, there's actually a couple of things that are at play here. I don't know that you don't watch much TV, but you'll see that Cablevision has these ads where they will offer you internet and phone service for something like $49 or some ridiculously cheap number than that, and they will install a TV antenna for you to get the 35-watt channel that you get. We live in a really densely populated part of the world. If you look at the rest of our country, aside from the few big cities that we have, there's lots of miles between TV transmitters and TV receivers and cable companies. Something like to build where they don't make a lot of money. So. We also have the FCC that is essentially, with the Congress, trying to sell off what was the free airwaves for the constituents of this country. And now with the newer FCC, which basically wants to take itself apart and not be involved in anything other than licensing, makes it that much more difficult because they wanted to give all these frequencies to the phone company to do, you know, WiMAX and all this 5G stuff. Which actually, the 5G stuff is going to wind up in a... They're going to try and chisel away some of the 3 gig band from it. There's all of these people who need TV equipment, and they need to know when a tornado is coming. And so on and so forth. Let me make it up. So, we don't see where the actual over the air CD is. There's a lot of them. And if you ever go through YouTube and look at the tower failures, you'll see 2,000 foot towers, 1,800 foot towers, and stuff like that. Why are the towers so tall? Because they've got to cover a lot of flat land, you know? So, in the short term, UHF has now been reduced to channel 35 and below. That's not going to go anywhere, but we in New York, this is going to be the interesting part, is that I'm going to tell you a quick little story that happened 2 years ago. There was a Channel 19 transmitter that used to be up in Darien, Connecticut, and they filed with the FCC and moved it to the same building that the theater is on. It is up again. To show you how dysfunctional the FCC is and how one hand doesn't bother to connect with another hand within the organization. They got permission and the construction permit to put it at Red Oaks, and they fired it up, and within 6 hours, police departments in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Connecticut and a few other places started complaining loudly. And the FCC made them shut it down. The FCC issues a license in a place where there is so much public service. We don't have a TV channel on 14, 15, 16. There is a 17. There's no 18. There's no 19. And it begins again at 20. And even 20 can only be low power because to the west of us, there's a lot of police departments, fire departments, and ambulances. It's going to be interesting to see how they repack this area. And that means that either they're going to move hundreds of public service organizations, or they've got a real problem. K2RW, K2J.
Until now, I thought we were allowed to use digital UHF television up to channel 53. Now you're telling me that everything above channel 35... is not going to exist for digital television anymore. Also, a year or so ago, you were a little bit afraid that over-the-air television broadcast is going to disappear with 47 million households using it. I think that's unlikely.
Well, the FCC has been trying to do that for ages, and it's still trying to do it. And now with its new organization, we don't know how fast or how not fast that's going to happen.
But 27 million households in the United States, that holds a lot of weight. That's an awful lot of angry people. You take their non-paying television away from them, I guarantee they're going to get angry and do something, as I see it, Eric, go ahead.
No, that's one of the arguments that seems to get knocked down by a particular group and particularly large group in Congress. That's not an unheard argument, it's still very loudly heard, but now, the guy that used to be in charge of the FCC was a cable guy, he came from the cable industry, and, you know, he was looking out for his best interest. His best idea is to make broadcasting over the air go away, which they've been trying really hard, except that they thought they were going to be able to sell... what was 180 megahertz worth of space? Except nobody would bid enough to be able to buy it. Now it's down to the selling, what is it, 80 megahertz of, you know, some smaller number. And this is after 7 rounds of this reverse auction.
Correct me if I'm right. We used to have digital television up to 53. Now we're not going to have any digital television above 35, if I understand correctly. and everybody's being squeezed into 35 and down. Is that sort of true?
That's correct. Without a lot of television, we couldn't have adjacent channels. Digital television is not a problem. So you can have a 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. You can fill up that whole space. So that one way to deal with it, actually the way the auction went is you sell your UHF and we'll give you X amount of money if you move to a high VHF. Or you sell your UHF and we'll give you a bit less money if you want to go to a low VHF. So that's one method. Another method is we take the empty spaces that are currently there and we fill them up. We move people, like, we have a, actually, the New Jersey station is on 52, which is supposed to move X number of years ago, but they got a variance. The phone company's still waiting to get their frequency. But now with the auction, they're moving again, so. The third method in which to, what they call a repack, is that, say, your Channel 9 and Channel 5, you're both the same company, you're both owned by Fox. Well, you sell one of your stations for $200 million, you lose Channel 9. But what you do is you put your streams on Channel 5, you keep it branded as Channel 9. And that's the other method.
Question? And before I go over that question, let me finish on this one. In the very near future, there will be nothing above Channel 35 on over-the-air broadcast television. How soon does that take place? And how many channels are there between 35 and 52 right now? Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, off the top of my head, I can't give you the numbers of how many there are right now. I mean, I could start counting on my fingers, but that wouldn't include everything around us that I don't look at. There's a list. Actually, everything above there isn't going to be empty. It's going to be, you know, the 700 megahertz band, the public service, the top part is 600, the phone stuff, the WiMAX stuff, and then you get as far as like 800, and then that becomes, you know, trunking again, so. And cell service also, so. You know, those with the biggest money had to, actually, they had to pay cash for this at the end of the auction, which is the funniest thing. That's the way it's going.
Okay, I'm only talking about the New York City area, Eric. Rough guess, are there 2 or 10 channels between 35 and 52 right now that have to move, and how soon do they have to move? Over to you, Eric.
The way things are scheduled, and the auction provided $3.5 billion for all the stations to move. The completion of the move, and the clock actually started last week, 39 months.
So within 39 months, which is what, essentially 3 and a fraction years, everything that's now between 35 and 52 will be gone. And what's your guess, very rough guess? Roughly 10 channels are in there?
Something like that. I think 33 is still reserved for the National Radio Observatory in Greenbelt, Maryland. So that's, you know, that's a quiet thing to see. Yeah. And then there was this life space stuff that they were really heavy on doing, and now all of that is in question. It's going to be thrown out the window. So don't forget, not only the U's, they could move to a different U when available, but they also have the option to go to either high B or low B.
Okay, we had another question. I think that was from Joe. The B2LYY, question mark, K2LYW.
Yeah, this is a broadcast question. Did WNBC relinquish RF Channel 4? Did WCBS relinquish RF Channel 2? And WNYW relinquish RF Channel 5 in the New York City area? Because there's something broadcasting on 2, but there's nothing on 4, nothing on 5 in the immediate New York area. And would they go back to that frequency and possibly sell a UHF counterpart frequencies? Back to you.
You've got it, Eric.
Now, the short answer to you, Joe, is yes. When they obtained their license, actually, the way this worked was there was a transition period where you continued to operate on VHF with your analog signal, and you operated your digital UHF. When the end of analog broadcasting went away, you lost the right to use that segment of VHF that you had your analog on. Now, it is the FCC that is assigning where you're going to go. Okay, if you've chosen that you want to be on a high VHF, the FCC is going to put you on the channel of their choosing, or actually, it's this computer program that looks at this appearance for, I think it's 600 miles radius or whatever it is. And actually, it's been changed a couple of times because of a lot of complaining that some of the broadcasts have done. But essentially, this program is going to put you in the appropriate place and for the amount of power output, not necessarily your transmitter power output, but what the ERP is of your station is going to be based upon a number of factors, including height and so on and so forth. So, 5 may wind up on 4, and 4 may wind up on 8. So, the list hasn't been published yet, but it's supposed to be published next week. We'll know exactly who's going to be where.
Well, if they decide to go on back, or somebody decides to go back on RF channel 2, is a low power religious station on that frequency occupying, what happens to them? They get simply booted off the air?
That issue is still unresolved. If you want a full power broadcast or a class A station, you may just be plain out of luck, like you go bye bye and that's it. That's going to happen to a lot of folks. And they're supposed to work out some kind of resolution with that. But now that the hands in the government have changed, nobody's quite sure what's going to happen. There's actually a whole bunch of lawsuits that are pending based upon that entire concept.
TTT?
I heard something like TTT. Kind of noisy guy. Go right ahead. Give us your full call and name.
Yes, of course. Tango. Is this an opportunity to get a 4-meter band? Is this an opportunity for us to get a 4-meter band at 70 megahertz?
I don't know of an American attempt to get a 4-meter band over here in the United States like they've got in the United Kingdom. Is that what you recognize also, Eric? K2EJ, K2IW?
Oh, I'm aware in Europe and a few other places they started utilizing those frequencies. We actually got a little segment between channel 5 and 6, or is it 6? No, between 6 and... Yeah, between 5 and 6. Or is it between 4 and 5? 76 megahertz. Considered to be a public service standard. It's still largely occupied, but, we're not changing the channel allocation, so... I don't know if that the FCC would actually give the hand that little bit of space, but who knows?
It would be lovely. Pardon my weak signal. Okay, very good.
You were only in there 20% of the time on that transmission, Gordon. At one time, Eric, I believed that the lower VHF channels were going to be very little used on digital television because of the high vulnerability to impulse noise. And all of a sudden, we have a channel 3 RF, which is channel 33 branded, seems to be working very well. Because that's true, I'm all of a sudden seeing that if it's done correctly, channel 2, 4, and 5 RF-wise could be very valuable over the air broadcast television channels. KE2J, K2LIW.
Yeah, Alf, you want to go back to 1998, when we all got together in our station and decided we want to go to UHF, and it took a lot of convincing, but no, let's stay on 15, it's a good place. The other thing is, from that point in time to where we are now, the improvement in being able to make an HDX signal and the improvement to be able to receive a HDX signal has, quadrupled a couple of times now. Even impulse noise down. And I wouldn't really want to be at 54 megahertz, but, it's doable.
Now, back in the analog days, because of the slight amount of arcing and sparking that occurs at one of the splices on the power line cable in front of my house, I would see these two white bars slowly drifting across the screen on channel 2, quite a bit dimmer on 4, a little bit dimmer on 5, and not present on 7. So that was arcing and sparking, impulse noise, 60 hertz rate. Are you saying that the modern day digital converters have something built into them so that impulse noise is no longer anywhere near as damaging as it used to be? W Eric, KQIW.
Oh, well, it's still damaging. There's no question about it. Although the recovery time for the data separator and the receiver has improved incredibly. Don't forget, when we started building this stuff, the chipset was like 10 chips to make the front end, and now it's a little, it's one VLSI that's basically in software, though. The kind of Altera chips that we use today, it's all run in VHDL, and as you learn stuff, you can change the software to make it better.
The digital converter chips in the front end of digital TVs today, how much more tolerant are they of co-channel interference? Oh, multipath. How much more tolerant are they of multipath today than they were when digital television first went on the air? Is there any way we can quantify that a little bit, Eric? KQIW?
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. There's a guy by the name of Mark Cuban who's pretty much the broadcast industry's guru of all things technical, so to speak. Although we got a couple. We got this guy by the name of Don Lung, who's the RF transmission guy. But Mark he has an appointment, and he actually lives in the Dakotas. He's a friend of mine. Him and his wife, actually, he's the chief audio engineer for the Lincoln Center. His wife is the coordinator for the apparatus. He put various different generations of converters in his apartment with the silver sensor antenna. I kind of talked about them a number of years ago when they dropped. He set them up on the same channel, pointed, downtown towards the Empire. And he would walk around the room. And the first generation converter would just, flip on and off and on and off. As, you found the right spot and you stood still and stay locked. Move around and was unlocked. The next generation of converter did a much better job of it. The last generation of converter, you can walk around the room and it doesn't bother it at all, so that gives you a little bit of a clue.
At one time, you were calling these converters third generation, fifth generation, seventh generation. Is there a number like that for the latest thing? And do you think my Vizio has it out of curiosity? Over to you, Eric.
Now, if you bought your Vizio within the last 3 years, I'd probably say it's probably fifth generation equalizer. The equalizer we're talking about. The equalizer's ability to look ahead, determine what's the main signal and what's the reflective signal. This concept of pre-ghost, before the ghost happens, so to speak, was that the equalizers were only capable of, I think we like 20 microseconds to 15 microseconds. Now we're talking about, what is it, 60 or 80 microseconds in the 7th generation equalizer. So you literally can take the antenna and walk around with it and have the thing stay locked. We're also doing something called DVSB or enhanced VSB, which allows for a portable device like a cell phone to be able to get reception moving around or in a vehicle driving around. By the way, the plus thing of ATSC3 and COFDM is you can drive with it and think it stays locked forever. KQRIWK2J.
When you're driving around with an automobile, the amount of multipath you get is huge, and it's continuously changing at a very fast rate. You're saying there's something magic about COFDM that it can tolerate that, or 8VSB has a greater problem with it? Go ahead.
Yeah, it actually does. Although if you have an EVSB receiver and you're lucky enough to be in a place where it's happening, you can drive around and get no disturbances either. It's actually piggyback, so to speak, on the ATSB screen, and it's got its own special sync bytes and stuff like that that allow this lower bitrate stream to be able to be retrieved even through the wilds of multipath.
In the next 39 months, we're going to go to ATS3. COFDM. It sounds like we are thoroughly abandoning 8VSB. We're all going to need brand new converters to get this new format over the air television broadcast. That's a lot of change. Are we about to thoroughly abandon 8VSB? And to some degree, did we make a little bit of a mistake to go there when Europe did not? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2IWK2J. As you know, Europe and Asia, except for Japan and Korea, always wanted to be different. That's why we have the difference in the vertical line frequency. HD in Europe is actually, what is it? Is it 1280? I'm trying to think. No, it's not 1280. It's another division based upon the line 50-50. But the method of COFDM for the analog stuff, or the basic stuff, is the analog stuff was 8 megahertz wide, so they maintain the 8 megahertz, and that's what they call DVB-T. So it's DVB, digital video broadcasting, terrestrial. And it comes in different flavors. You can run it 6 megahertz like us. You can run it 7, 8, 10, depending on what country and what they chose. And the difference, having more space, of course, allows you to run your streams at higher rates, which means you can pack more stuff in it.
So it sounds like from traditional early days, their channels are 8 megs wide, even though ours are 6 megs wide. That gives them more capability. But when a channel is 8 megs wide, to get the right signal-to-noise ratio is a little bit more difficult, as I see it. Greater information rate is the good news, but to get the same signal-to-noise ratio, you need a little bit more power. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
As I said an hour ago, it takes more power in COFDM. That's because of all these little carriers that you're creating. One of the things about Europe, even in the analog days, is that their sync and video are opposite of what we do. Whereas the sync in Europe is the lowest power. And the reason, the thinking behind that is that when there's DX, because you might be next door to another country that will use a slightly different standard. Is that the sync won't bang into each other. So in Europe, if you've got a weak signal on analog, picture in lock. It had nothing to lock to. It might have slowly rolled vertically, but the maximum power is in the white rather than in the sync.
Our analog television, our NTSC, had maximum power on the sink. That allowed you to run a gated AGC system and sink separator. What in the world did they use for the AGC system if the sink is the weakest signal in your WR?
Same thing. It's just the sink has to be big enough. But in their case, people tend to be very closely located to transmitters. I mean, you look at the size of some of these countries, they're no bigger than Rhode Island.
So you believe that the analog television with negative power, not positive power, on the sink, so to speak, was a successful analog technique in the old days of the UK, say, K2LAW?
Well, in the United States, your coverage area may be, you know, as far as you can get to your horizon, whereas in Europe, you may not go more than 20 miles. So they would rather actually have more power in the picture to keep the signal noise down in terms of the image that you're watching, as opposed to the deadlock in that.
If I can't run my automatic gain control circuit on a standardized amplitude signal, like the top of the sync pulses in our case, how in the world do I standardize the gain of that receiver? Because if it's the video is being used as the maximum power, there are times when you're transmitting a black signal picture, sometimes you're transmitting a white picture, and so that video power drastically changes. Is there a standard tiny little pulse of a signal somewhere in their format that allows them to set the automatic gain control? Over to you, Eric.
Well, let's see, Dick. You work on TV sets when, in the 50s or 60s?
Roger. 60s and 70s.
And that was before the creation of what we call RS-170 or 178. We actually stopped using the sink tip, and we used the pedestal. We used the little teeny bit of space at the top of the sink just after the bed. And some sets would actually use the breezeway as the point to clamp and send now information to the AGC. Use that same principle on the inverted step two. So when the signal is strong enough that you've got something that you can slice and decode, you've got enough information.
If we're not keying on the peak of the sync pulse, but we're doing something else on the back porch, front porch, whatever, vestibule, why bother continuing to transmit that sync pulse if no one's using it?
Well, in essence, you don't have to, but then what you would be getting in your receiver is a burst of noise, wouldn't you?
If I knew what was going to happen, I could gate out the reception of the set at that time. Okay. Time to go over to the space report. I said that once before. And so, Paul, you don't want to discuss that subject. Maybe after you give your space report, I'll discuss it. I'll use a friendly language. WS2N, with space report number 239, K2LAW in the tech man. You got it, Paul. By the way, Mr. Musk made a real good launch very recently with the SpaceX, didn't he?
He certainly did. Just heard another station. Good anyway. Okay. Yeah, well, as far as the spaces, your average working day, they don't go longer than 8 hours in the spacesuit anyway, so I don't know what they're pushing for. I think I would need a rest after 8 days, 8 hours in a spacesuit. It would be time to come in. You gotta go lunch or something. That's the main topic this morning at 9:38 plus 59 seconds. Elon Musk, SpaceX launched the Dragon / Falcon 9 from Launch Complex 39A. We talked about last week, and sure enough they accomplished that. They tried to do that yesterday, but they had a problem with the vector on the second stage. Apparently I was giving them problems, but they called a hold at 13 seconds. We dropped it. And then what they did yesterday was they lowered the whole rocket down, and you know, from vertical to horizontal, and they swapped that piece out right there, and then they raised it back up, and they were ready this morning, 24 hours later, and they successfully launched that rocket from a my point of view. I was very surprised. They had rain an hour earlier, but then Florida cleared up a little bit. They had heavy cloud cover, but they took off anyway. Went right through the clouds. And, you know, 1.7 million pounds of thrust. That thing keeps going higher and higher every time, you know, every time you turn around, he keeps bringing that thrust level higher and higher. So now, you know, it's a one-second window. He had to go off exactly on time because he doesn't have enough fuel to change inclination to get to the space station. So he had to wait for the space station to be right overhead. So this morning he went off. About 9 minutes later, the booster, which is about 15-story tall, 12-foot diameter, it's like a 15-story 12-inch pipe coming flying out of space, came all the way back from separating from the second stage. After separating from the second stage, it has these nitrogen jets, which enables it to turn around 180 degrees and fire its three Merlin D engines out of the nine on board. They fire three, and that's pushing them back to Cape Canaveral. And then again, the nitrogen thrusters fire again, and it starts to turn the rocket engine facing down, and then it comes through the atmosphere at very high speed, probably in the 3,000 mile an hour speed. He starts firing these other three engines again to slow them down, and these fins open up near the top of the rocket. They act as, you know, they guide it down like a dart, you know, like feathers on the back of a dart, and it helps them get back to their landing complex. And then right before they land, you know, they see them come through the cloud. You know, they have cameras on board. You can watch this whole thing, looking down from the top of it. They fire one center rocket of the Falcon 9. And, you know, just the last few seconds, the legs open up. You can see the four legs open up. And then lands almost dead center on his landing zone. He calls it Landing Zone 1. Used to be called Launch Complex 13, but he took that over. Now it's called Landing Zone 1. Successfully landed, and they'll eventually probably use that booster again. Very successful. The second stage pushed the Dragon into orbit, and that will catch up to the space station on early Wednesday morning. And Shane Kimbrough, one of the astronauts on board, will grab it with the robotic arm, dock it to the node, actually berth it to the node, 16 bolts. It'll be all bolted up automatically. And then after that, they'll be able to open up the doors and get out, you know, over 5,000 pounds of stuff has gone up to the space station. Experiments, food, clothes, and Dragon has a trunk. The back half of it has equipment that will be eventually removed by station's robotic arm. And then one